Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears back with you here on a Getaway Friday, November the 11th, 2022, 11-11-22, 15 and a half minutes past the hour. And as many of you know, today is Veterans Day. And as we did last year, thanks to Terry Klein, we have put together a Veterans Day program here for your enjoyment. Wherever you are, we will be on with this program for the next two solid hours, and then Linda Sims will join us 12 to 1 today for the Exchange Club. So we're going to start the program as we did last year. We have three veterans in the studio here, and we're just going to have them introduce themselves and tell us basically a little bit about themselves. So we'll start over here.
Well, thanks. Put me on the spot. I was hoping you're going to start with
Randy. You start the other way?
Yeah. It always works away. No, I'm Ralph Litcher, and I'm a retired Army aviation officer. Spent almost 25 years in service, and just really, really enjoyed it, and I'm glad to be out and meeting folks like Randy and the other veterans here in town.
All right.
Hi, I'm Sherry Bosley Litcher. Yes, I'm married to Ralph. We met in the service, and I have 31 years in before I retired. I started out as a private, thought I was going to leave as a private, but somehow the bug stuck, and 31 years later, I found myself saluting the flag for the last time on the parade field. So I'm happy to be here, and whatever we want to talk about, we've been having quite the conversation prior to going on air here. We're looking forward to what comes our way.
Absolutely.
Good morning. My name is Randy Drasba, and I'm a Vietnam veteran. I belong to and active in the Vietnam Veterans Chapter here in Marion County, Chapter 1117. I'm secretary of the chapter, but more prominently, I'm chairman of the Marion Military Banner Program. And we started that last year, and we'll talk a little bit more about it as we head into next year.
Well, for people who don't know what that is, tell how that all got started and where it goes from here.
Well, it actually got started, rumbling around in various military organizations. The Korean War veterans, which are really up there in age, were the ones that really kick-started this whole program, but they felt that they were too old to carry it forward, so they leaned on us Vietnam veterans to get it started. In fact, one of the prominent members of our banner committee was Dick McDaniel, and Dick was 90 years old, or about 90, when the whole thing started, and sadly he passed away this past year. But not until he saw that this whole program was a success. That's how it got started. And when we initially set the thing up, we had no idea how it was going to be received by the veteran community in Marion County. Our initial goal was to sell 20 banners. And we got to 20, and then, well, okay, maybe it'll go a little further, so we expanded it out to 100. And, well, today we have 305 banners up in the air, we couldn't have done it without a lot of help from various organizations, but especially the veterans of Marion County, and veterans' families of Marion County.
When you drive around Marion now and you see those banners on the poles, how does that make you feel?
Well, it makes me feel proud that Marion has not forgotten, perhaps what the price of freedom is. And also, people see us veterans with our hats on, and they'll say, thank you for your service. And I see people up on the banner, and I think of the same thing. And I also think about it as honoring other veterans that had a worse time, or their service was more hardship than what I endured. So I thank them as well. And in fact, I'm dressed in my honor guard uniform. We have a funeral today, so I also extend my method of honoring soldiers by help participate in military rites.
You know, Sherry, when you drive around and see those banners, what's it make you think about?
Oh my gosh, you know what? Even the routes I drive every day, I still find myself looking at and reading those banners and looking at the faces, and I just, it's just a sense of awe as I drive around. And the sheer number, Randy kind of alluded to it, that turned out last year was amazing. There's many more veterans that could be recognized, but we had, what, 300, Randy?
305.
305. Just a tremendous turnout. Randy was telling me that they thought they might get 20 people to respond. But it's just a sense of awe, and it's just a cornucopia of emotions that I feel when I look at some of the pictures, and imagining what their experience was like, imagining what their family's experience was like, especially when I pass the ones that didn't make it back home. But it's just, like I said, I'm overwhelmed, and it gives me, when I pass my own families, it just gives me a sense of joy and pride that we can still honor them in that way.
Ralph, what do you think when you pass them?
So, I mean, I guess I could concur with everything they said about the pride and the emotions, but one of the things that strikes me when we're looking at these banners, because we have walked around a lot to look at them, is how many families are military families. So you'll see a couple of banners, and Randy and the guys have done a great job of getting those families right next to each other. So you have to actually understand the era of the uniforms to tell who was father, who was son, whether they're brothers. But when we look around, I'll bet of those 305, it's probably closer to just 100 and some families by the time you get out there. And I think it really speaks to the family nature of military service. You'll find that if a grandfather served and a son served, then a son or daughter is probably going to serve a nephew. And you kind of get that lineage. And that really does show itself on these banners. So I think that's one of the things that strikes me as I look at it. It's kind of a visual representation of that family business that the military really is.
Speaking to that family business, tell me about the moment when you knew this is something you wanted to do. How did you come to that conclusion?
Mine was probably a little bit different than others. I was going to college. My college roommate was an ROTC student, and I was waiting for him to sign some paperwork. And they came out and talked to me a little bit, and I got involved with the program and then got a scholarship and thought, well, this will be great. I'll see what I can do. And as soon as I got into flight school, I knew I was never going to leave. I was going to be leaving kicking and screaming, because flying helicopters is the greatest fun you can ever have.
What did that recruiter say to you that was impressive, that got you involved?
it was an Army captain who came out, and after he introduced himself and figured out who I was, said, hey, how would you like to play on our flag football team for the college, our intramural team? I'm like, sure. And that just got me in. But what it really did, and he was smart enough to figure it out, that when you get in and start feeling the camaraderie of being around an organization like that and the friendships you make, and then with the captains and majors that are around that program explaining to you that that's a camaraderie you're going to feel in the military, and what leadership is really going to be. And quite frankly, I thought it was just crazy that the people of this country were going to entrust their sons and daughters without knowing me, willingly take them down to the recruiter, and I would find myself as a second lieutenant in charge of them. that trust that the American public puts in the leadership of the military is phenomenal. You don't know who these folks are. No one knew Sherry or I when they signed their kids up to come work for us. But they did, and they trusted, in our case, to take them to combat in, for her, Desert Storm, you know, Operation Iraqi Freedom in Afghanistan. So we saw all that, you know, when you're lining up to do that and realize that trust, I think that's a big, you know, kind of a, it strikes you at the moment when you're about to do it. So it was a lot of fun. Wouldn't trade it for anything.
Sherry, tell me about the moment that you knew this is something you wanted to do.
That moment actually probably was after my first enlistment, and I had, I guess I should back up a little bit. I came in the service because I was looking for a way to continue my education, and I was working and trying to put myself through school, and that was going really slow, and I'm impatient. And I was the youngest of 10 kids, so I didn't feel that my parents should be spending their retirement years supporting my college education. So I did my enlistment and earned my college money. And I was assigned to Fort Bragg, and I was leaving Fort Bragg. They sent me through what you call an in-service recruiter, who convinced me to continue to serve while I was going to school. And so I, before I ever left Fort Bragg, I signed up to also be in the Ohio National Guard when I came back here. So I literally, because school was already in session, I literally left Fort Bragg one day and was sitting at Ohio State the next day, and then the following day met with the representative from the Ohio Guard. And somewhere around in school, I'd always planned, well, I'm just going to stay in the reserves. I'm going to, you know, finish my commitment, finish school, and stay in the reserves, do that for a while. But somewhere along the line while I was in school, I just had this aha moment where I started saying, you know, I felt like I was doing something important. I felt like I was doing something that was going to matter. And I enjoyed it. And like Ralph was talking about, just the friendships and the camaraderie, it's unmatched. And until you experience it, it's hard to explain it. And I certainly, you know, had reservations when I first left about leaving. In fact, you asked about the recruiter. I almost turned around in the MEP station and walked out the door, and the recruiter stood in front of the door and said, "You really want to do this?" And I'd already signed my initial paperwork, and but I still could have changed my mind. And I just looked at him for a second, and I said, "Okay, what, you know, if I don't do this, what will I do?" So there was kind of a couple of pushes along the way, but ultimately, after my initial service, and then once I left and realizing what I missed about it, even then I thought I was only going to come back and go on active duty again for a little while, but I just kept getting up every morning and putting one foot in front of the other, and you really feel that sense of responsibility towards those that you serve with. And there was always a, well, I can't leave them now, I can't leave them you know, without a team member. So there was always something that kept me going and ended up in the long career that I had.
Randy, how'd you get involved?
I want to say that having us three people here today was not prearranged in my mind. You have a person here that's chairman of the Marion Military Banner Campaign, and you got two other people that bought the most banners for Marion, and I think we have 13 banners.
15 now.
15 banners. They start on they're on Mount Vernon Boulevard. Can't even think. It's right there where Vernon Heights Boulevard is.
Runs into Mount Vernon Avenue.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Sefner.
It's Sefner. Sefner, yeah. Down on the east side of Mount Vernon Avenue, all the way down to near Forest. Mm-hmm. And it's quite a stretch of 13 banners from one family like that, and we certainly appreciate that assistance. The other thing that's interesting about this, you have two professional people that joined the service and were able to take advantage of that for educational, vocational backgrounds, and that's an important thing that young kids ought to take notice that you could take the training that you get in the military and put it to some type of avocation that you could use forever. For me, I was I graduated from college, West Virginia University, in August of 1968. And because I had changed a couple different colleges, Uncle Sam looked at me as a career student trying to stay in school to dodge the draft. So it wasn't a month later, in September of 68, I got my greetings from Uncle Sam, and I was off to the service, and including a year in Vietnam. So it was a little bit of a different situation. However, it happened that way. I was went and served, came home, went to graduate school on a GI Bill, and was able to live comfortably with that. So it certainly helped me with some of my educational expenses.
You know, the draft is interesting because now it's been so long ago since we've had one, more than 40 years, that most people now don't really realize what that was or why that was happening. Kind of explain to people what it was, why it was happening. They've heard the word, but I don't think they really know what the meaning is.
Well, you had your draft cards, the local draft board. You had to sign up with them so they can sort of keep tabs on what you were doing. They did, at a point in time, allow college students to defer their draft status, but that started to change when, in the later 60s, they were having issues getting enough draftees incorporated into the service, and it had a demand, so they changed it to they would set aside 4 years of college, be draft deferred, and then after that you had to serve. But if you're a doctor or a dentist, they would allow you to continue on for 6 or 8 years, whatever it took to get your doctorate degree, whatever, so you could practice. But then once you achieved that status, then they would take you in the draft. So it was interesting. I was drafted in August of 68 with a herd of other professional people. In my basic training company or platoon, we had two lawyers that were caught up in it. They had just graduated and they were drafted. I didn't have any doctors or dentists in that, but it was interesting, professional people. Now, when I went to Vietnam, we got perhaps scattered about. I never noticed, you know, we were working with any professional people over there. But anyhow, it changed. It was because they needed to get people incorporated into the service. Then they, after I was drafted, they incorporated a lottery. So it was based upon your birth date, and they would actually have set up a lottery system, and they, whatever was your date, if it came up, it went down so far, they were going to draft 200 dates or whatever, and the people that their birthdays fell down below that 200, they didn't get drafted. So I was, unfortunately, I missed that opportunity. I didn't get luck of the draw. I was drafted.
Yeah. When you look back at that, let's start here. So Vietnam active duty for Randy. Now, Sherry, how were you involved in what do we say, is it always war, conflict? We call it all different things, I guess. What things were you involved with?
Operations?
Operations.
Okay. Yeah, sometimes they're war, sometimes they're conflict, sometimes they end up just being some operation, and sometimes it's just peacetime service. So I was in, I first enlisted in 85, but the first major operation I was involved in was actually when I came back on active duty, and I went to Operation Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And then I was, I didn't go there, but I supported actions in the Balkans. And then obviously 2001 happened, which engaged most of us. So I was among the first conventional troops that were sent into Afghanistan. I deployed on Christmas Day, which Ralph remembers well. Ralph was actually in this Special Operations Aviation at the time, and I deployed before he did. And his boss said, "What? They're deploying her on Christmas Day?" And then we came out of Afghanistan and virtually rolled right into Iraq when the approval came to launch into Iraq.
Now, what type of things were you involved with in those operations?
By those years, I was a logistics professional, and so I operated at every level of logistical performance, from direct support, served a lot of time in brigade combat teams, serving the direct support of the infantry and armor, and artillery, and aviation, and then later on, I served as a battalion commander, serving at a theater level, where I was, one of the major roles I had was I was responsible for all the mortuary affairs from all over the theater throughout Iraq and Afghanistan and other areas when we were operating in that area. So in some form of support at a variety of levels up through the day I retired.
Ralph, operations you were involved with?
I was primarily an enduring freedom, Iraqi freedom guy. I'd done tours to Egypt and Korea prior to that, but when the war kicked off, as Sherry said, I was in charge or in a special operations aviation regiment at the time. So deployed there as an operations officer. I was primarily operations my entire time in the Army. So serving in direct support of infantry and special operations forces. Did do a little bit of time doing intel work for aviation units as well, but we were kind of unique, I guess, as a couple. We deployed to in different units to Afghanistan for the initial invasion and hadn't seen each other in quite some time, and in the middle of the kickoff of a very large operation, we ran into each other on a operation center floor. While she was supporting all the troops there, and I was working as a liaison for the aviation element. So we've had some interesting things. When we went into Iraq, we were both in the same brigade combat team as battalion executive officers, her for the support battalion, myself for the aviation battalion, supporting in the 101st for the large air assault that we did going in the for the initial invasion. So we've had some interesting times, some very funny, and some less so. But it was a lot of fun.
You know, Randy, when we think about Vietnam, you know, obviously this country's sentiment changed at some point during Vietnam, and it was not the greatest time here. A lot of protests, a lot of things of that nature. Are you aware of that when you're over there, that that's going on here?
Oh, yes. We got news. There was Vietnam radio out of Saigon. We knew what was going on, but you didn't really have time to really pay attention to it. It didn't change any philosophy. Everything was more, you know, into what you were doing. And talking about that, I was assigned to way down in the southern part of Vietnam in the Ba Sac lower region of the Mekong Delta at a station that near a community called Canto. And in that, it was a large army air base, just bringing in shipments of supplies and so forth. And we were heavily guarded by some like 5 helicopter companies plus other support units. And being a college graduate, a civil engineer, what does the Army do with you? Well, you go through a battery of tests, and they determine that I could send and receive shortwave, which I never did any of that before in my life. So they sent me to radio school, which was an 8-week school in Fort Knox, Kentucky. And you learn how to send and receive shortwave, as well as voice communications, and a little introduction into operating small to large radios. It was an 8-week course, and at 5 weeks, for some reason, they had a need for radio teletype operators. So they came around to, it was open up to anybody that could get a secret crypto classification. If you could pass a secret crypto classification, which it was all, they did all that, it was a background check, and I think nobody ever failed that. But anyhow, they the ones that wanted to go on to that, they shipped us from Fort Knox down to Fort Gordon, Georgia, in the Signal Corps, and it was a level week course in training of operating a radio teletype machine. I felt, you know, here's a big piece of equipment, and maybe it was had a computer or something, or it would have to be air conditioned, and if the equipment had to be air conditioned, I would be air conditioned. And also, if it's, you're in something that's got an air conditioning, it might be more secure than carrying a rifle over there. So it behooved me to take advantage of this additional training. And of course, it was 11 weeks. It was 11 weeks I wasn't in Vietnam, so it was great. So anyhow, but we were one of 7 classes all got shipped to Vietnam, and not everybody can go over there carrying a rifle. They need support staff, and that's what we did. I was assigned to a reconnaissance company, and it was the Army's largest fixed-wing airplane at the time. It was called the OV-1, which was a lookout plane for jets that the Air Force used, and they were retiring it, so they gave it to the Army, and the Army loaded it up with all kinds of surveillance equipment, and they would take it and fly missions throughout southeast part of Vietnam, as well as Cambodia, and bring all this information back, and an intelligence platoon went through and deciphered what that equipment was telling them, and they created messages. They brought that information over to us, and we took it and put it into a way to convey it. And at that time, we were operating an electric typewriter that was mechanically hooked to a tape puncher. So it was the long ribbon of tape, you know, it was popular all the way back to World War II, you know, when the soldiers were going down to New York City and all the paper tape was flying in the air. That was that type of paper tape that we were punching over in Vietnam. So that's what we did. Messages. We had two large size trailer size radios sitting out back of our operating headquarters, which is a 30-foot wide Quonset hut, and our office was in the back of that Quonset hut. Nobody, not even the E7 platoon sergeant or the company officer, second lieutenant, could come into the office. They could go up to the doorway because they didn't have a secret crypto classification, which was kind of stupid. They should be able to peer in and watch what we were doing. But anyhow, We also had landline communication, so we didn't have to use the radios. We had to keep the radios ready to operate in case something terrible happened, but we could actually go across the compound, and our messages were sent out by landline through different areas of Vietnam and to something like 20-25 areas, locations in the United States, including the White House. Now, why would the White House need all this information, the details of what was going on in Vietnam? But they did. They got that information.
It's very interesting because during the Vietnam era, there are maybe three television channels, certainly no internet, no cable television, completely different time. But by the time Iraq is happening, the Iraq War in 2003, there's cable television, there's internet, there's broadcast stations, there's a whole lot of stuff going on. And a lot of the talk, certainly on those news stations, was about the Iraq War during that time. And maybe other than Vietnam, there was not the best feeling about that war here in the United States. Were you both aware of that while you were there and in how the mood was kind of changing?
I would say yes, we were aware of it. I remember being in Afghanistan and our brigade talk and listening to the radio of some of the hearings where they were talking about whether we should go into Iraq. And so we were aware of the different sides of the coin that people were on from the very beginning.
Knowing that there is a group, that a big group, that doesn't like this idea, does that have any impact at all?
I don't think it did. I mean, that's what we're about, is a free country. You know, going to war is not an easy decision, and there should be differing opinions on it, especially when we were talking about Iraq, because it was a totally different animal. When we went into Afghanistan, we were going after the group that attacked us. So Iraq was a different animal, so it was a totally different discussion, and I would hope that people would have, you know, some intelligent, rational disagreement on that.
You know, a job, a religion, whatever people are involved in groups, it's interesting because people might follow that, people might go to work every day, but they don't agree with everything that goes on, but they still do it. Is there any aspect of that to the military, or do you have to believe everything and go along with it?
Oh, there's a two-part question, actually. No, you don't have to drink the Kool-Aid. But yes, you have to do your job.
Well, and not to spend too much time on this, but, you know, a lot of people listening were around during Iraq, mm-hmm. and do remember Iraq, and the predicate for that was weapons of mass destruction, which, to my knowledge, were not found. How do you feel about that now? And at that time, did you think they were there?
No, there was a lot of questioning around the military. I mean, inside, we don't advertise our disagreements. But there was a lot of questioning inside about whether Iraq really had weapons of mass destruction. We knew Iraq, you know, the link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda just historically hadn't been there. So we questioned that because, you know, during Desert Storm, bin Laden actually made an offer to go get Saddam Hussein and bring down that country's leadership. They were not friends, and they had different objectives. So certainly we had lots of facts to rely on to say, are they really there, or are we being fed and you know, information that isn't accurate by countries who have an interest in us going in there.
Ralph, when that can be said, Sherry just said there, everything she just said, when that is starting to kick off, and there is a question, you know, these people are not friendly with each other, but yet this is what the president at the time, the secretary of state, UN hearings are all saying, what's going through your mind as you're getting ready to go in there?
I think at the level that we were at the time, now we were both majors, so that is a leadership role, but it's kind of at that tactical leadership. Your focus is on the people you're leading. So the political discussion is something that you hope is had back here in a rational manner, but your focus is, we're going to go do this whether we agree with it or not. So how do we best prepare our organizations and our soldiers to accomplish this and survive? Because that's really where your focus is at our level. We weren't at the White House or, you know, the Pentagon writing, you know, point papers at that time. So I think your focus becomes on the people. How do I support my boss? How do I support my fellow leaders? And how do we do all that while supporting the soldiers and making this happen as quickly as we can?
I was just going to interject. It's what you commonly hear when you're, and Randy, I'm sure you've said this yourself, is that when you're in those situations, you're not thinking about mom, apple pie, and country. You're thinking about each other, and you're fighting for and with each other, and so that we all come home as a team.
I have a question similar for Randy here in a second about Vietnam to the one I'm going to ask Ralph and Sherry here. But I was on the air during the Iraq War. I've been around that long now. And a lady called in. I'll never forget this, and maybe you two are the ones to answer this. And I'll never forget she called in. I certainly didn't have an answer for it, and I never really heard an answer. But at that time, for people who were not around, we did have cable television. They were all running. And at that point, President Bush came on television, and he said, this is the time and date. We're going to go in. Get out. Saddam, leave Iraq. Go to an island somewhere. Don't be there. They dropped flyers before we came in, telling them we were coming. They took over their television and radio signals and told them we were coming. And if you would have looked at any news channel, Fox News, MSNBC, CNN, there was a little clock in the corner of the screen to the minute when we were going to go in. And a lady called in during that time, and I'll never forget this, and she said, if our government believed for a second that they had weapons of mass destruction, why would they send ground troops in and tell them when they were going to do it? Because at that moment, if you had them, being a country like that, you think that would be the time to use them. You would put all those troops in peril because you're telling them we're coming.
So I think there was a lot going on at that time, and there was a feeling amongst the intelligence world, and that's the strategic intelligence world, that Saddam didn't necessarily have the support of his military. So we were briefed a lot on not so much the fights we were going to be in, but how to receive a military unit when they surrendered or capitulated on the battlefield. And there was a lot of talk about that while we were sitting in Kuwait about, hey, we think most of these military units are going to throw up their hands, drop their weapons, and surrender. And the resistance that we met on that initial invasion wasn't great. Units were really not fighting. There was a couple of places when we flew into Karbala and a couple of those that were exceptions to that where we got into real fights. But there was a lot of cases where units just kind of melted away. People took off their uniforms and melted back into the civilian population and went back to their families. And so I think that's what started that. We thought, man, if we can get them all to surrender and we don't have to fight at all, This is how we can best do it. And I think in a lot of ways, we didn't plan for the overwhelming success that we were about to have. I think that was one of the three-star General Wallace. Yeah. Said to us afterwards, you know, because he was a three-star that was a ground commander of that said, you know, we'd heard all this, but we didn't really believe it, and we didn't plan for that success, so we didn't have the things to run cities, to run police forces, to help employ the military set up right away, and that'll let things go bad later on, because we assumed we were, you know, even though we were saying they're going to capitulate, we assumed we were going to have to fight.
And there was precedence from Desert Shield, Desert Storm, of those techniques you just listed about dropping leaflets saying, we're going to bomb here tomorrow, we're going to fire artillery here tomorrow, don't be near your equipment. We used to drop leaflets with images of them missing their family back home and encouraging them to leave their posts and go back home, and it was effective. And we would, I was in the artillery then, and so we would do artillery raids and destroy radar sites that were totally unmanned when we got there, you know, for instance. So it was a precedence that those techniques worked with that population. They weren't committed to the fight that they were in.
Randy, similar question about Vietnam. At that time, we had a president, Lyndon Johnson, who a lot of people feel did not run for another term because of Vietnam. We had remember, three television networks for people out there. You had a gentleman named Walter Cronkite who went over there and came back and said this, essentially, if you look at his editorial, this isn't working. We had Nixon come in and was embroiled in other things, and a lot of people felt was doing things in Vietnam to get the attention off of his own problems, Watergate at that time. What was the feeling in Vietnam? Was there a feeling of, we can make what we set out here to do happen, or there's a lot of things going on by big people back home that are causing big problems here?
Well, it's interesting. President Johnson, I agree with what you said. The Vietnam War caused him to be a one-term president, and then Nixon came in. But over there, operating under a Democratic president, change over to a Republican president, you didn't see any difference. So I was over there the year of May of 69 to May of 1970. Vietnam had been going on, you know, starting in the early 60s, so this is getting kind of old. The attitudes of the soldiers was really not that good. And drugs of all types were running rampant. And there were us non-druggies that were concerned about our safety. And when you were out on guard duty, you're out on the perimeter. Well, and there's the barbed wire fencing and so forth to keep the enemy at bay beyond the perimeter, but then you're actually guarding your bunker because you're not sure that the guys over the next bunker are not high on drugs and so forth to let the enemy seep into their area. So everybody was sort of like that. They took care of their own bunker, their own area. And that's not a day-to-day thing because we, like I said, we were radio teletype operators, but from time to time we had duty, which allows me to go to another area. When I first got into my company and I was introduced to a radio teletype operator who had spent he was just about to be released after spending his year there. And he says, I want to give you the scoop of how we operate this thing. He says, we're not really doing our day-to-day job, so to speak, and we must be behind maybe 6 months on all these messages that come in from the intelligence department. And sure enough, the inbox was stacked way up with all kinds of messages that weren't getting out. And they were doing that on purpose because, like I said, nobody knew what they were doing. And I says, well, so what do you do? And he says, well, we goof off. We play cards and this and that. And I says, you know, I got a whole year to spend over here, and, you know, I never really liked to play cards that much, you know. I think I'm going to do my duty and see what that brings us. And the Army understood we were behind, so they sent two or three others behind me. So we actually turned over the department and got the old guys out of the way that were not doing anything, and we got everything caught up in short order of time. And that, it did, they didn't have to perform guard duty because they were so far behind. Well, we got caught up in sure enough, we got assigned to guard duty. So, but it wasn't that bad. You know, every month or so, you got to go out on a it was almost like a different activity, a different experience.
We're joined in studio today for our Veterans Day program here by Randy, Sherry, and Ralph, and we're going to step out here for about 10 minutes for news and weather, but we've got a whole nother hour coming up, so stay tuned. Lots more to talk about here on WGH Talk, streaming live all over the world at WWGH1071.com, and remember, you can download the free TuneIn app absolutely free on any mobile device and search WWGH. Back in about 10.
The Talking Place. For people like the first female Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright.
If Donald Trump does get in, what kind of damage could he do? He's got to deal with Congress, the Senate, the Supreme Court. From somebody who's been there and dealing with foreign countries, if he's in there, what could there be a bad future?
I'm concerned about that. I have said that if he gets elected,